Mike, and thanks Yulia and Vivian and Kay too for sharing something of your life and your stories and your insights about the shape of love in your own world and your experience there. Really appreciate just your openness and sharing those with us. And thanks, Jill, for leading us this morning. I feel like I am just a beginner in the lessons of love. I find I often struggle with different dimensions of it. And I struggle often with the people who are closest with me to love them well. When people don't live up to my desires or my expectations, when something that they do or fail to do offends or wounds or hurts me, I often find myself in a bit of turmoil. I'm sure that you're all developed beyond this, so what I have to share this morning may not need to land in the way it needs to land with me. So maybe this is a sermon for myself, but hopefully this little window into my world will also help you reflect on yours. And we will take time to think of the world that Jesus inhabited, especially in this passage. But recently, someone close to me said no when I asked them for help. Now, they're perfectly entitled to say no, and they're perfectly entitled to say no without any explanation whatsoever. They don't owe that to me. But the reasons that they gave for saying no seemed a little bit trivial to me, and I mulled over their refusal. I ruminated, and I relayed the events and the conversations and the messages, and I started having thoughts like, he knew that would make it difficult for me. I don't think he was being truthful about his response. And then I kind of moved into another part of mulling, which was just a little bit more dark. Next time he asked me for help, I'm sure I can think of a reason to say no. I imagined myself having a conversation with him where I declined a similar request. I marinated in that for a little while. And for a fleeting moment, it felt smugly satisfying. I was tempted to embrace my shadow side and go full noise in that dark space, entertaining my dark angels. I was feeling the hurt. I was poking the wound. I was reliving the pain. It was a minor wound, really, just a scratch. But it had hit a tender spot in my inner world and a fragile part of my ego. I realized that I needed to find a way of transforming my pain, or I was surely going to finish up transmitting it back to the other person. I would damage that relationship and others around me if I lingered in that space. And eventually my thoughts were led back to this passage that we've read this morning, Jesus washing feet and offering bread to those who let him down. And I began to consider how my own pain and hurt might be transformed, how my own mind and heart and body might be moved in the direction of love. One of the things I've observed about life is that that pain in relationship and offense is inevitable, especially if you're going to get close. You can't get close to people without becoming vulnerable, and because the people who inhabit our world are imperfect like us, inevitably at some point, offense will occur, hurt will occur, wounds will be embedded sometimes into our lives, or we'll be afflicted with wounds, and we'll have to find a way forward from that place of woundedness. So being wounded is somewhat inevitable in life. Forgiveness, however, and love is optional. We can choose to direct our minds and hearts and bodies into the journey of love. So let's come to this passage that we've read this morning. Jesus tells Judas that he will betray him, that he will hand him over to the religious authorities. We know that Judas is eventually going to sell him out for 30 coins of silver, about 4 months' wages and tradies' wages, is what some of the scholars say the equivalent would be. Today's money, maybe about $8,000. I'm not a tradie, but a tradie, calculating the wages, would finish up with about that. So Judas is going to betray Jesus for 4 months' wages, set him up to be captured. And Jesus paints the picture of what this is like by saying, "He who shared my bread has turned against me. He who shared my bread has turned against me." And in doing that, he takes words from Psalm 41, which is a psalm of David, a song of David, a song of complaint, a song of lament, a song in which David is bringing his own pain before God. Trying to understand the context in which David wrote that psalm is a little bit hit and miss, but most scholars will point to the incident or the experience in David's life where his son Absalom rises up in rebellion against his father, and one of King David's closest confidant, thank you, I knew I had it wrong. His confidant is a man called Ahithophel. There we go. I think we've finally got there with that one. Ahithophel. And gosh, I'm glad my mother didn't name me that. But this man who has been a court advisor, a confidant, has been close to David, is now working together with his son to betray him and seek to bring down the kingdom. And David writes this psalm out of that experience of betrayal by his son and by his advisor. And Jesus takes these words from that song to paint a picture of what he is now experiencing, that Judas, this man who he has called into his circle of close friends, who has traveled and eaten and lived and stood beside him in the same toilet, if they had toilets there. That's a very intimate experience, isn't it? who has been a part of his life closely for so long, has now come to this point of betraying him. And Jesus is feeling the burn of this betrayal. He knows Judas is about to sell him out. He knows that Judas's greed and avarice, his covetousness, will override his loyalty to Jesus. And knowing this, what does Jesus do? He takes up the role of a house slave or a servant. He strips off the clothing that he doesn't need, picks up a towel, bends down, and washes Judas' feet. And then he gets up, he puts that garment back on, he sits at table, and he offers him the bread and the wine of hospitality and fellowship. This for the confidant who has been a part of his life for these 3 years, who he has poured his heart and soul and life into, seeking to teach him and disciple him into, apprentice him into the ways of love. And then he comes to Peter. Peter, who is this disciple who seems to suffer from foot and mouth disease. He's just so eager, so impetuous, but so genuinely sincere about his loyalty and his faithfulness, who says, "I'll lay down my life for you, Jesus." Peter is an even closer friend than Judas. He's been there as part of the inner circle. He's been present with Jesus during some of his most vulnerable moments, a participant in some of his most intimate conversations. And in this Gospel of John, he's the one who stays when others leave. Earlier in the Gospel, when Jesus has been teaching them about the bread of life, and he says, unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you can have no part with me. And he's speaking metaphorically, but people are finding this teaching difficult, and it says some left him. And Jesus says, what about you? Do you want to leave too? Almost like saying, well, you know, if this is too hard for you, I'm not going to hold you here. I'm not going to coerce or manipulate you into staying. You can go too. And Peter says, well, where would we go? You're the only one who has the words of eternal life. You're the only one who nourishes our humanity in the ways that we instinctively know we need to be in the world. And then he says, we believe and assure that you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. So Peter is loud and proud about his commitment. He's the one who stays when others leave. He's the one who holds on to relationship when others break it. Here at this moment, Jesus has to alert him to the shadow that lurks within his own life. And he tells Peter that he too will break under pressure. Fear and the instinct for self-preservation will overrule that commitment and that loyalty. And Peter will disown him. Peter will deny him. The rock, Peter, will crumble under the weight of this particular temptation. So what does Jesus do? Knowing this, what does Jesus do? Well, he does the same thing to Peter as he's done to Judas. He takes up the role of the house slave and the servant. He picks up the towel. He bends down. He washes Peter's feet. And then he gets up and takes up the role of the welcoming host. And he offers Peter the bread and wine of hospitality and fellowship. So here is this Jesus in the Gospels. He knows he will be betrayed, denied, and abandoned by his closest friends. Those he has poured his life and love into. And this knowledge is like a slashing knife. It is cut deeply into his heart and mind. He is already bleeding on the inside while he's kneeling down to serve on the outside. He's cut to the core by these thrusts from his friends. He still washes their feet. He still stays at the table of fellowship and still offers the bread and of hospitality. The deepest and most painful wounds that Jesus sustains are not the whip, they're not the thorns, they're not the nails or the spear. They are the psychological sword thrusts of abandonment and betrayal and denial by his friends. And yet he still serves them and does them good. He recycles grace. He keeps offering faithful love and preemptive forgiveness. He keeps giving them his best when they are at their worst. He keeps doing them good when they do him harm. He remains faithful in the face of their unfaithfulness. Jesus is the wounded son, the crucified God, the wounded healer, the one who absorbs all of those failures and transforms them into love. I know there are multiple questions that arise from this way of Jesus about some of the pain that we sustain in a relationship, particularly close ones, and particularly where there's trauma and ongoing hurt involved. This is not to suggest that those issues are not complex or challenging or we need assistance to work our way through them, but it's holding up for us a possibility in our relationships that is transformative. So instead of recycling, being kept in cycles of hatred and unforgiveness, we can be moved into cycles of grace. The Christ in John's Gospel, and interestingly, the first chapters of this are sometimes referred to as the Book of Signs, and the second part of the Gospel is referred to as the Book of Glory. And in this first few chapters leading up to this event where Jesus is washing their feet, We see Jesus turning water into wine, driving disease out of bodies, regenerating withered limbs, restoring the sight of a man born blind, raising Lazarus to life. And this life heals and transforms the bodies of those people. But what is happening here in chapter 13 is we're seeing that this life can heal and transform the deepest and most painful human wounds. This life and love can make places of pain launching pads for love. This life and love can transform the currents of pain that course through our life into currents of grace. Now, I love what Richard Rohr says. He says that if we do not transform our pain, we will always transmit it. We often hear that encapsulated, don't we, in the observation that hurt people. Just a slightly more sophisticated way of saying the same thing. But let me say that again. If we do not transform our pain, we will always transmit it. Rohr goes on to say, someone always has to suffer because we don't know how to suffer. That's what it comes down to. Most people are like electric wires. What comes in is what goes out. Someone calls us a name, we call them a name back. Someone gives us the fingers when we're going through traffic. We, maybe not visibly, if you can't bring yourself to do that, but maybe you give them the proverbial finger back. Most people pass on the same energy that is given to them. Now compare an electric wire, he says, to those big grey transformers that you see on utility poles, not so many around now. But dangerous current or voltage comes in, but something happens inside that box. And what comes out is, in fact, now helpful and productive. That's exactly what Jesus does with this pain. He doesn't return the negative energy directed at him, not during this life, nor when he hangs on the cross. He holds it inside and transforms it into something different. That is how he took away the sin of the world. He refused to pass it on. And when the world understands that, then the world can be transformed. When we individually understand that and find a way into the grace that makes it possible, we are transformed. And when a church grasps that, wow, because we are all beset and befuddled by the energy that pushes us to transmit the pain. And we're invited in Jesus into the energy that transmits the grace. Yet at the beginning of this gospel, John sets us up for that, doesn't he? He says, you know, the law came through Moses, but grace and truth came through Christ. And then it says, and we've all received from him grace upon grace, upon grace, upon grace, upon grace. That's what's being transmitted through Jesus. We know what happens when we're wounded. Sometimes we're puzzled why we feel so wounded. Things inside of us that have become tender spots that get pressed through circumstance and through others, our hot buttons that we aren't even aware of. We don't know how they got there, but somehow tender places within us that get pushed. But we've felt the wounds of betrayal, perhaps. I think it's a miracle that I feel like it's a miracle. It's grace that I'm even in pastoral ministry these days. I know I've hurt a lot of people through my sins of commission and omission. I'm grateful for the grace that's been extended to me in forgiveness and embraced my humanity and my mistakes. I've also been on the receiving end of things that have left me deeply, deeply hurt. And times when I thought, why the hell would I want to go back into pastoral ministry? Do I really want to go back to that? And yet I find this whisper within me and a whisper in the world that says, there's a way above that and a way to lift me into places where I too can learn to not only receive graciously the forgiveness that's extended to me for my failings, but forgive myself and then forgive those also who inevitably in community because of our shared humanity will be those through whom I receive hurt as well. Here in Jesus, we're offered a way of going forward in grace. Jesus helps us break the cycle. He washes our feet and feeds us the bread and wine of fellowship. He pours his grace into us so that we can pour it into others. He washes our dirty feet and serves up the same grace to us as he does to Judas and to Peter. Henri Nouwen, reflecting on some of the passages in life that that he has traveled through and the difficulties in relationships, found himself on one occasion imagining the voice of Jesus speaking to him and saying, "Let go of your complaints. Forgive those who loved you poorly." That's our shared humanity, isn't it? We love poorly. But we're called to continue the journey. And he says, step over your fears of feeling rejected. Have the courage to trust that you won't fall into the abyss of nothingness, but into the safe embrace of a God whose love will heal all your wounds. And he goes on to say that forgiveness is the name of love practiced among people who love poorly. The hard truth is that we all love poorly, and we need to forgive and be forgiven every day, every hour, increasingly. This is the great work of love among the fellowship of the weak that is the human family. You know, a church is a community of people who learn to extend grace and forgive in the way of Jesus, as captured for us in this story. Let me finish with another story. Some of you may be familiar with Christiane Amanpour, who is a US journalist, and has done quite a bit of work with CNN. Now, when we start mentioning media companies today, it all starts to get a little bit political, doesn't it? But, you know, CNN is the company that she has done a lot of work with. But she interviewed a woman in Rwanda named Iphigenia. I may be pronouncing that wrong. If so, my apologies. She was from the Tutsi tribe, and during the Rwandan genocide of 1994, her husband and five children were clubbed and hacked to death by a mob of Hutus, including one of her neighbours. And the neighbour who participated in the massacre spent 7 years in prison, then went to a tribal court where he asked forgiveness from Iphigenia and the whole community. She opened her heart and she forgave her community. Now, that one line sentence can't capture all of the agony and pain and conflict that she must have gone through in order to come to that kind of place. But that was the journey that she took. I won't hold on to the hurt. I will try and find a way of fast-forwarding grace. The story didn't end there, because Iphigenia, a master weaver, taught her neighbor's wife how to weave baskets. And the two became friends and business partners. And on the day that Christiane Amanpour was interviewing her, she had invited these same neighbors into her home, and she was serving them dinner. That's right, she was serving them dinner. Dinner to the man who had killed her husband and her children. And when she was asked how she found it in her heart to play grace forward, she said simply, "I'm a Christian and I pray a lot. I'm a Christian and I pray a lot." And even that doesn't capture what the journey has been. But it points to the source of inspiration and energy for that kind of journey and that kind of way. So my little scratch, relational scratch, over somebody who simply didn't offer me what I wanted when I felt that I needed, is nothing like these deep wounds that we read of with Jesus and this woman. But for all of us, there's a grace that's available to help us mold these relationships together. And Jesus delights to give it. Thanks, Joe.